Aristotle, and a host of other philosophers, all destined to take different paths, derived more from Socrates' character than from his words. It was not Epicurus' school, but living under the same roof as Epicurus, that turned Metrodorus, Hermarchus, and Polyaenus into great men. And yet I do not summon you to my side solely for the sake of your own progress, but for my own as well, for we shall be of the utmost benefit to each other. Meanwhile, since I owe you the daily allowance, I'll tell you what took my fancy in the writings of Hecate today. What progress have I made? I am beginning to be my own friend. That is progress indeed. Such a person will never be alone, and you may be sure he is a friend of all. Letter number 7. You ask me to say what you should consider it particularly important to avoid. My answer is this: a mass crowd. It is something to which you cannot entrust yourself yet without risk. I, at any rate, am ready to confess my own frailty in this respect. I never come back home with quite the same moral character I went out with. Something or other becomes unsettled where I had achieved internal peace. Someone or other of the things I had put to flight reappears on the scene. We who are recovering from a prolonged spiritual sickness are in the same condition as invalids, who have been affected to such an extent by prolonged indisposition that they cannot once be taken out of doors without ill effects. Associating with people in large numbers is actually harmful. There is not one of them that will not make some vice or other attractive to us, or leave us carrying the imprint of it, or bedaubed all unawares with it. And, inevitably enough, the larger the size of the crowd we mingle with, the greater the danger. But nothing is as ruinous to the character as sitting away one's time at a show. For it is then, through the medium of entertainment, that vices creep into one with more than usual ease. But what do you take me to mean? That I go home more selfish, more self-seeking, and more self-indulgent? Yes, and what is more, a person crueler and less humane through having been in contact with human beings. I happened to go to one of these shows at the time of the lunch hour interlude, expecting there to be some light and witty entertainment then, some respite for the purpose of affording people's eyes a rest from human blood. Far from it. All the earlier contests were charity in comparison. The nonsense is dispensed with now. What we have now is murder pure and simple. The combatants have nothing to protect them. Their whole bodies are exposed to the blows. Every thrust they launch gets home. A great many spectators prefer this to the ordinary matches, and even to the special popular demand ones, and quite naturally. There are no helmets and no shields repelling the weapons. What is the point of armour, or of skill? All that sort of thing just makes the death slower in coming. In the morning, men are thrown to the lions and the bears, but it is the spectators they are thrown to in the lunch hour. The spectators insist that each on killing his man shall be thrown against another to be killed in his turn, and the eventual victor is reserved by them for some other form of butchery. The only exit for the contestants is death. Fire and steel keep the slaughter going. And all this happens while the arena is virtually empty. But he was a highway robber. He killed a man. And what of it? Granted that as a murderer he deserved this punishment, what have you done, you wretched fellow, to deserve to watch it? Kill him, flog him, burn him. Why does he run at the other man's weapon in such a cowardly way? Why isn't he less half-hearted about killing? Why isn't he a bit more enthusiastic about dying? Whip him forward to get his wounds. Make them each offer the other a bare breast and trade blow for blow on them. And when there is an interval in the show, oh, let's have some throats cut in the meantime so that there's something happening. Come now, I say. Surely you people realize, if you realize nothing else, that bad examples have a way of recoiling on those who set them. Give thanks to the immortal gods that the men to whom you are giving a lesson in cruelty are not in a position to profit from it. When a mind is impressionable and has none too firm a hold on what is right, it must be rescued from the crowd. It is so easy for it to go over to the majority. A Socrates, a Cato, or a Lelius might have been shaken in his principles by a multitude of people different from himself. Such is the measure of the inability of any of us, even as we perfect our personality's adjustment, to withstand the onset of vices when they come with such a mighty following. A single example of extravagance or greed does a lot of harm. An intimate who leads a pampered life gradually makes one soft and flabby. A wealthy neighbour provides cravings in one. A companion with a malicious nature tends to rub off some of his rust, even on someone of an innocent and open-hearted nature. What, then, do you imagine the effect on a person's character is when the assault comes from the world at large? You must inevitably either hate or imitate the world. But the right thing is to shun both courses. You should neither become like the bad, because they are many, nor be an enemy of the many, because they are unlike you. Retire into yourself as much as you can. Associate with people who are likely to improve you. Welcome those whom you are capable of improving. The process is a mutual one. Men learn as they teach. And there is no reason why any pride in advertising your talents abroad should lure you forward into the public eye, inducing you to give readings of your works or deliver lectures. I should be glad to see you doing that, if what you had to offer them was suitable for the crowd I've been talking about, but the fact is, not one of them is really capable of understanding you. You might perhaps come across one here and there, but even they would need to be trained and developed by you to a point where they could grasp your teaching. For whose benefit, then, did I learn it all? If it was for your own benefit that you learnt it, you have no call to fear that your trouble may have been wasted. Just to make sure that I have not been learning solely for my own benefit today, let me share with you three fine quotations I have come across, each concerned with something like the same idea. One of them is by way of payment of the usual debt, so far as this letter is concerned, and the other two you are to regard as an advance on account. To me, says Democritus, a single man is a crowd, and a crowd is a single man. Equally good is the answer given by the person, whoever it was, his identity as uncertain, who, when asked what was the object of all the trouble he took over a piece of craftsmanship, when it would never reach more than a very few people, replied, "A few is enough for me, so is one, and so is none." The third is a nice expression used by Epicurus in a letter to one of his colleagues. "I am writing this," he says, "not for the eyes of the many, but for yours alone, for each of us is audience enough for the other." Lay these up in your heart, my dear Lucilius, that you may scorn the pleasure that comes from the majority's approval. The many speak highly of you, but have you really any grounds for satisfaction with yourself if you are the kind of person the many understand? Your merits should not be outward-facing. Letter number 8. "Are you, of all people," you write, "really telling me to avoid the crowd, to retire from the world and find contentment in a good conscience? Where are those Stoic rules of yours that call on a man to die in harness?" Oh, come now. Do I really give you the impression that I advocate a life of inactivity? I have only buried myself away behind closed doors in order to be able to be of use to more people. With me, no day is ever whiled away at ease. I claim a good part of my nights for study. I have no time for sleep. I just succumb to it, keeping my eyes at their work when they are heavy-lidded and exhausted from lack of rest. I have withdrawn from affairs as well as from society, and from my own affairs in particular. I am acting on behalf of later generations. I am writing down a few things that may be of use to them. I am committing to writing some helpful recommendations, which might be compared to the formulae of successful medications, the effectiveness of which I have experienced in the case of my own sores, which may not have been completely cured, but have at least ceased to spread. I am pointing out to others the right path which I have recognized only late in life, when I am worn out with my wanderings. "Avoid," I cry, "whatever is approved of by the mob, and things that are the gift of chance. Whenever circumstance brings some welcome thing your way, stop in suspicion and alarm. Wild animals and fish alike are taken in by this or that inviting prospect. Do you look on them as presents given you by fortune? They are snares. Anyone among you who wishes to lead a secure life will do his very best to steer well wide of these baited bounties, which comprise yet another instance of the errors we miserable creatures fall into. We think these things are ours, when in fact it is we who are caught. That track leads to precipices. Life on that giddy level ends in a fall. Once, moreover, prosperity begins to carry us off course, we are no more capable even of bringing the ship to a standstill than of going down, with the consolation that she has been held on her course, or of going down once and for all. Fortune does not just capsize the boat, she hurls it headlong on the rocks and dashes it to pieces. Cling, therefore, to this sound and wholesome plan of life. Indulge the body just so far as suffices for good health. It needs to be treated somewhat strictly to prevent it from being disobedient to the spirit. Your food should appease your hunger, your drink quench your thirst, your clothing keep out the cold, your house be a protection against inclement weather. It makes no difference whether it is built of turf or of variegated marble imported from another country. What you have to understand is that thatch makes a person just as good a roof as gold does. Spurn everything that is added on by way of decoration, and display unnecessary labour. Reflect that nothing merits admiration except the spirit, the impressiveness of which prevents it from being impressed by anything. If these are the things I'm saying to myself, if these are the things I'm saying to future generations, don't you think I'm doing more good than when I go into court to enter into a recognizance on someone's behalf, or stamp my seal on a will, or lend my assistance by word or action in the Senate to some candidate for office? Those who appear inactive are, believe me, engaged in far more important activity. They're dealing with matters divine and human at the same moment. But the time has come to make an end, and, in accordance with the practice, I've started to make some disbursement on this letter's behalf. For this, I shall not draw on my own resources. I'm still turning over the pages of Epicurus, and the following saying, one I read today, comes from him. To win true freedom, you must be a slave to philosophy. A person who surrenders and subjects himself to her doesn't have his application deferred from day to day. He's emancipated on the spot, the very service of philosophy being freedom. Quite possibly you'll be demanding to know why I'm quoting so many fine sayings from Epicurus, rather than ones belonging to our own school. But why should you think of them as belonging to Epicurus, and not as common property? Think how many poets say things that philosophers have said, or ought to have said, not to mention the tragedians, or our native Roman drama, which has a serious element in it as well, and stands halfway between comedy and tragedy. Think of the quantity of brilliant lines to be found lying about in farces alone. Think of the number of Publilius's verses that really ought to be spoken by actors wearing the tragic buskins instead of barefooted pantomime actors. I'll quote one verse of his which belongs to philosophy, and the same facet of philosophy that I was occupied with just now, a verse in which he proclaims that gifts which chance brings our way are not to be regarded as possessions. If you pray, a thing may, and it does come your way, 'tis a long way from being your own. I recall your expressing the same idea a good deal more happily and succinctly. What fortune has made yours is not your own. And I can't pass over that even happier expression of yours, the boon that could be given can be withdrawn. This being from your own stock, I am not debiting it to your account. Letter number 9. You desire to know whether Epicurus is right in one of his letters, in criticizing those who maintain that the wise man is content with himself and therefore needs no friend. This is what Epicurus objects to in Stilbo, and those who believe that the supreme ideal in life is a mind devoid of feeling, or, as we say, impatiens. We are bound to involve ourselves in ambiguity if we try to express in a single word the meaning of the Greek term apatheia by transferring it straight into our word impatientia. For it may be understood in the opposite sense to the one we wish, with people taking it to signify the man who is unable to endure anything that goes badly for him, instead of what we mean by it, the man who refuses to allow anything that goes badly for him to affect him. Consider, then, whether it might not be preferable to call it a mind that is invulnerable or above all suffering. The difference here between the Epicurean and our own school is this. Our wise man feels his troubles but overcomes them, while their wise man does not even feel them. We share with them the belief that the wise man is content with himself. Nevertheless, self-sufficient though he still desires a friend, a neighbour, a companion. Notice how self-contented he is. On occasion, such a man is content with a mere partial self. If he loses a hand as a result of war or disease, or has one of his eyes or even both put out in an accident, he will be satisfied with what remains of himself, and be no less pleased with his body, now that it is maimed and incomplete, than he was when it was whole. But while he does not hanker after what he has lost, he does prefer not to lose them. And this is what we mean when we say the wise man is self-content. He is so in the sense that he is able to do without friends, not that he desires to do without them. When I speak of his being able to do this, what I am saying in fact amounts to this. He bears the loss of a friend with equanimity. Not that he will then be without a friend, for it is his to decide how soon he makes good the loss. Just as Phidias can carve another statue straight away if he loses one, so our wise man, with his skill in the art of making friends, will fill the place of someone he has lost. I suppose you will want to know how he will be able to make a friend so quickly. Well, I shall tell you. Provided we agree that I may make this the moment to pay my debt and square my account so far as this letter is concerned. I shall show you, says Hecato, a love philter compounded without drug or herb or witch's spell. It is this. If you wish to be loved, love. Great pleasure is to be found not only in keeping up an old and established friendship, but also in beginning and building up a new one. There is the same difference between having gained a friend and actually gaining a friend, as there is between a farmer harvesting and a farmer sowing. The philosopher Attalus used to say that it was more of a pleasure to make a friend than to have one. In the same way as an artist derives more pleasure from painting than from having completed a picture. When his whole attention is absorbed in concentration on the work he is engaged on, a tremendous sense of satisfaction is created in him by his very absorption. There is never quite the same gratification after he has lifted his hand from the finished work. From then on, what he is enjoying is the art's end product, whereas it was the art itself that he enjoyed while he was actually painting. So with our children. Their growing up brings wider fruits, but their infancy was sweeter. To come back to the question, the wise man, self-sufficient as he is, still desires to have a friend, if only for the purpose of practicing friendship and ensuring that those talents are not idle. Not, as Epicurus put it in the same letter, for the purpose of having someone to come and sit beside his bed when he is ill, or come to his rescue when he is hard up or thrown into chains, but so that, on the contrary, he may have someone by whose sick bed he himself may sit, or whom he may himself release when that person is held prisoner by hostile hands. Anyone thinking of his own interests and seeking out friendship with this in view is making a great mistake. Things will end as they began. He has secured a friend who is going to come to his aid if captivity threatens. At the first clank of a chain, that friend will disappear. These are what are commonly called fair-weather friendships. A person adopted as a friend for the sake of his usefulness will be cultivated only for so long as he is useful. This explains the crowd of friends that clustered around successful men, and the lonely atmosphere about the ruined, their friends running away when it comes to the testing point. It explains the countless scandalous instances of people deserting or betraying others out of fear for themselves. The ending inevitably matches the beginning. A person who starts being friends with you because it pays him will similarly cease to be friends because it pays him to do so. If there is anything in a particular friendship that attracts a man other than the friendship itself, the attraction of some reward or other will counterbalance that of friendship. What is my object in making a friend? To have someone to be able to die for, someone I may follow into exile, someone for whose life I may put myself up as security and pay the price as well. The thing you describe is not friendship, but a business deal, looking to the likely consequences with advantage as its goal. There can be no doubt that the desire lovers have for each other is not so very different from friendship. You might say it was friendship gone mad. Well, then, does anyone ever fall in love with a view to a profit or advancement or celebrity? Actual love in itself, heedless of all other considerations, inflames people's hearts with a passion for the beautiful object, not without the hope, too, that the affection will be mutual. How, then, can the nobler stimulus of friendship be associated with any ignoble desire? You may say, we are not at present concerned with the question whether friendship is something to be cultivated for its own sake. But this, on the contrary, is exactly what needs proving most. For if friendship is something to be sought out for its own sake, the self-contented man is entitled to pursue it. And how does he approach it? In the same way as he would any object of great beauty, not drawn by gain, not out of alarm at the vicissitudes of fortune. To procure friendship only for better, and not for worse, is to rob it of all its dignity. The wise man is content with himself. A lot of people, Lucilius, put quite the wrong interpretation on this statement. They remove the wise man from all contact with the world outside, shutting him up inside his own skin. We must be quite clear about the meaning of this sentence and just how much it claims to say. It applies to him so far as happiness in life is concerned. For this, all he needs is a rational and elevated spirit that treats fortune with disdain. For the actual business of living, he needs a great number of things. I should like to draw your attention to a similar distinction made by Chrysippus. The wise man, he said, lacked nothing, but needed a great number of things. Whereas the fool, on the other hand, needs nothing, for he does not know how to use anything, but lacks everything. The wise man needs hands and eyes and a great number of things that are required for the purposes of day-to-day life, but he lacks nothing. For lacking something implies that it is a necessity, and nothing to the wise man is a necessity. Self-contented as he is, then, he does need friends, and wants as many of them as possible. But not to enable him to lead a happy life, this he will have even without friends. The supreme ideal does not call for any external aids. It is home-grown, wholly self-developed. Once it starts looking outside itself for any part of itself, it is on the way to being dominated by fortune. But what sort of life, people may say, will the wise man have if he is going to be left without any friends, when he is thrown into prison, or stranded among foreigners, or detained in the course of a voyage in distant parts, or cast away on some desert shore? It will be like that of Jove, while nature takes her rest of brief duration. When the universe is dissolved, and the gods are all merged in one, finding repose in himself, absorbed in his own thoughts. Such is more or less the way of the wise man. He retires to his inner self, is his own company. So long, in fact, as he remains in a position to order his affairs according to his own judgment, he remains self-content even when he marries, even when he brings up his children. He is self-content, and yet he would refuse to live if he had to live without any human company at all. Natural promptings, not thoughts of any advantage to himself, impel him towards friendship. We are born with a sense of the pleasantness of friendship, just as of other things. In the same way as there exists in man a distaste for solitude and a craving for society, natural instinct drawing one human being to another, so too with this, there is something inherent in it that stimulates us into seeking friendships. The wise man, nevertheless, unequal though he is in his devotion to his friends, though regarding them as being no less important, and frequently more important than his own self, will still consider what is valuable in life to be something wholly confined to his inner self. He will repeat the words of Stilbo, the Stilbo whom Epicurus' letter attacks when his home town was captured, and he emerged from the general conflagration, his children lost, his wife lost, alone, and nonetheless a happy man, and was questioned by Demetrius. Asked by this man, known from the destruction he dealt out to towns as Demetrius the City Sacker, whether he had lost anything, he replied, "I have all my valuables with me." There was an active and courageous man, victorious over the very victory of the enemy. "I have lost," he said, "nothing." He made Demetrius wonder whether he had won a victory after all. "All my possessions," he said, "are with me," meaning by this the qualities of a just, a good, and an enlightened character, and indeed the very fact of not regarding as valuable anything that is capable of being taken away. We are impressed at the way some creatures pass right through fire without physical harm. How much more impressive is the way this man came through the burning and the bloodshed and the ruins, uninjured and unscathed. Does it make you see how much easier it can be to conquer a whole people than to conquer a single man? Those words of Stilbo's are equally those of the Stoic. He too carries his valuables intact through cities burnt to ashes, for he is contented with himself. This is the line he draws as the boundary for his happiness. In case you imagine that we Stoics are the only people who produce noble sayings, let me tell you something. See that you put this down to my credit, even though I have already settled my account with you for today. Epicurus himself, who has nothing good to say for Stilbo, has uttered a statement quite like this one of Stilbo's. "Any man," he says, "who does not think that what he has is more than ample, is an unhappy man, even if he is the master of the whole world." Or if you prefer to see it expressed like this, the point being that we should be ruled not by the actual words used, but by the sense of them, "A man is unhappy, though he reign the world over, if he does not consider himself supremely happy." To show you, indeed, that these are sentiments of a universal character, prompted evidently by nature herself, you will find the following verse in a comic poet. "Not happy he who thinks himself not so." What difference does it make, after all, what your position in life is, if you dislike it yourself? What about so-and-so, you may ask, who became rich in such a despicable manner, or such-and-such a person who gives orders to a great many people, but is at the mercy of a great many more? Supposing they say they are happy, will their own opinions to this effect make them happy? It does not make any difference what a man says. What matters is how he feels, and not how he feels on one particular day, but how he feels at all times. But you have no need to fear that so valuable a thing may fall into unworthy hands. Only the wise man is content with what is his. All foolishness suffers the burden of dissatisfaction with itself. Letter number 11. I have had a conversation with your talented friend. From the very beginning of his talk with me, it was apparent what considerable gifts of character and intelligence he possesses. He gave me a foretaste of his capabilities, to which he will certainly live up, for the things he said, caught as he was quite off his guard, were entirely unrehearsed. As he was recovering his self-possession, he could scarcely get over his embarrassment, always a good sign in a young man, so deep had the blush been that suffused his face. This, I rather suspect, will remain with him even when he has built up his character and stripped it of all weakness, even when he has become a wise man. For no amount of wisdom enables one to do away with physical or mental weaknesses that arise from natural causes. Anything inborn or ingrained in one can by dint of practice be allayed but not overcome. When they face a crowd of people, some men, even ones with the stoutest of hearts, break into the sort of sweat one usually sees on persons in an overheated and exhausted state. Some men experience a trembling at the knees when they're about to speak. Some a chattering of the teeth, a stuttering tongue or stammering lips. These are things which neither training nor experience ever eliminates. Nature just wields her power and uses the particular weakness to make even the strongest conscious of her. One of these things I well know is a blush, which has a habit of suddenly reddening the faces of men of even the most dignified demeanour. It is, of course, more noticeable in the young, with their hotter blood and sensitive complexions. Nevertheless, seasoned men and ageing men alike are affected by it. Some men are more to be feared on the occasions when they flush than at any other time, as if in so doing they let loose all their inhibitions. Sulla was at his wildest when the blood had rushed to his visage. No features were more susceptible than Pompey's. He never failed to blush in company, and particularly at public meetings. I remember Fabianus blushing when he appeared to give evidence before the Senate, and this bashfulness looked wonderfully well on him. When this happens, it is not due to some mental infirmity, but to the unfamiliarity of some situation or other, which may not necessarily strike any alarm into inexperienced people, but does produce a reaction in them, if they are thus liable through having a natural physical predisposition to it. Certain people have good, ordinary blood, and others just have an animated, lively sort of blood that comes to the face quickly. No amount of wisdom, as I said before, ever banishes these things. Otherwise, if she eradicated every weakness, wisdom would have dominion over the world of nature. One's physical makeup and the attributes that were one's lot at birth remain settled, no matter how much or how long the personality may strive after perfect adjustment. One cannot ban these things any more than one can call them up. The tokens used to portray embarrassment by professional actors, those actors who portray emotions, simulate unhappiness, and reproduce for us fear and apprehension, are a hanging of the head, a dropping of the voice, a casting down of the eyes, and keeping them fixed on the ground. A blush is something they can never manage to reproduce. It is something that will neither be summoned up nor be told to stay away. Against these things, philosophy holds out no remedy, and avails one nothing. They are quite independent. They come unbidden, they go unbidden. My letter calls for a conclusion. Oh, here's one for you. One that will serve you in good stead, too, which I'd like you to take to heart. We need to set our affections on some good man, and keep him constantly before our eyes, so that we may live as if he were watching us, and do everything as if he saw what we were doing. This, my dear Lucilius, is Epicurus' advice. And in giving it, he has given us a guardian and a moral tutor, and not without reason, either. Misdeeds are greatly diminished if a witness is always standing near intending doers. The personality should be provided with someone it can revere, someone whose influence can make even its private inner life more pure. Happy the man who improves other people not merely when he is in their presence, but even when he is in their thoughts. And happy, too, is the person who can so revere another as to adjust and shape his own personality in the light of recollections even of that other. A person able to revere another thus will soon deserve to be revered himself. So, choose yourself a Cato, or if Cato seems too severe for you, a Lelius, a man whose character is not quite so strict. Choose someone whose way of life as well as words, and whose very face, as mirroring the character that lies behind it, have won your approval. Be always pointing him out to yourself, either as your guardian or as your model. There is a need, in my view, for someone as a standard against which our characters can measure themselves. Without a ruler to do it against, you won't make the crooked straight. Letter number 12. Wherever I turn, I see fresh evidence of my old age. I visited my place just out of Rome recently, and was grumbling about the expense of maintaining the building, which was in a dilapidated state. My manager told me the trouble wasn't due to any neglect on his part. He was doing his utmost, but the house was old. That house had taken shape under my own hands. What's to become of me if stones of my own age are crumbling like that? Losing my temper, I seized at the first excuse that presented itself for venting my irritation on him. "It's quite clear," I said, "that these plane trees are being neglected. There's no foliage on them. Look at those knotty, dried-up branches and those wretched, flaking trunks. That wouldn't happen if someone dug round them and watered them." He swore by my guardian angel he was doing his utmost. In everything his care was unremitting, but the poor things were just old. Between you and me now, I had planted them myself, and seen the first leaf appearing on them myself. Then, turning towards the front door, I said, "Who's that? Who's that decrepit old person? The door's the proper place for him, all right. He looks as if he's on the way out. Where do you get him from? What was the attraction in taking over someone else's dead for burial?" Whereupon the man said, "Don't you recognize me? I'm Felicio. You used to bring me toy figures. I'm the son of the manager, Philositus, your pet playmate." "The man's absolutely crazy," I said. "Become a little child again, has he? Actually called himself my playmate? Well, the way he's losing his teeth at this very moment is perfectly possible. So I owe it to this place of mine near town that my old age was made clear to me at every turn. Well, we should cherish old age and enjoy it. It's full of pleasure if you know how to use it. Fruit tastes most delicious just when its season is ending. The charms of youth are at their greatest at the time of its passing. It is the final glass which pleases the inveterate drinker, the one that sets the crowning touch on his intoxication and sends him off into oblivion. Every pleasure defers till its last its greatest delights. The time of life which offers the greatest delight is the age that sees the downward movement, not the steep decline already begun. And in my opinion, even the age that stands on the brink has pleasures of its own, or else the very fact of not experiencing the want of any pleasures takes their place. How nice it is to have outworn one's desires and left them behind. Well, it's not very pleasant, though, you may say, to have death right before one's eyes. To this I would say, firstly, that death ought to be right there before the eyes of a young man, just as much as an old one. The order in which we each receive our summons is not determined by our precedence in the register. And secondly, that no one is so very old that it would be quite unnatural for him to hope for one more day. Every day, therefore, should be regulated, as if it were the one that brings up the rear, the one that rounds out and completes our lives. Pacuvius, the man who acquired a right to Syria by prescription, was in the habit of conducting a memorial ceremony for himself, with wine and funeral feasting of the kind we are familiar with, and then being carried on a bier from the dinner table to his bed, while a chanting to music went on of the words, he has lived, in Greek, amid the applause of the young libertines present. Never a day passed by, but he celebrated his own funeral. What he did from discreditable motives, we should do from honourable ones, saying in all joyfulness and cheerfulness as we retire to our beds, I have lived, I have completed now the course that fortune long ago allotted me. If God adds the morrow, we should accept it joyfully. The man who looks for the morrow without worrying over it knows a peaceful independence and a happiness beyond all others. Whoever has said, I have lived, receives a windfall every day he gets up in the morning. But I must close this letter now. What? You'll be saying. Is it coming to me just as it is, without any parting contribution? Well, don't worry. It's bringing you something. Why did I call it something, though? It's a great deal. For what could be more splendid than the following saying, which I'm entrusting to this letter of mine for delivery to you? To live under constraint is a misfortune, but there is no constraint to live under constraint. Well, of course not. When on every side there are plenty of short and easy roads to freedom, there for the taking. Let us thank God that no one can be held a prisoner in life. The very constraints can be trampled underfoot. Oh, it was Epicurus who said that, you protest. What business have you got with someone else's property? Whatever is true is my property, and I shall persist in inflicting Epicurus on you, in order to bring it home to the people who take an oath of allegiance to someone and never afterwards consider what is being said, but only who said it, that the things of greatest merit are common property. Letter number 15. Our ancestors had a custom, observed right down as far as my own lifetime, of adding to the opening words of a letter, I trust this finds you as it leaves me in good health. We have good reason to say, I trust this finds you in pursuit of wisdom, for this is precisely what is meant by good health. Without wisdom, the mind is sick, and the body itself, however physically powerful, can only have the kind of strength that is found in persons in a demented or delirious state. So this is the sort of healthiness you must make your principal concern. You must attend to the other sort as well, but see that it takes second place. It won't cost you any great trouble if good health is all you want, for it is silly, my dear Lucilius, and in no way for an educated man to behave, to spend one's time exercising the biceps, broadening the neck and shoulders, and developing the lungs, even when the extra feeding has produced gratifying results and you've put on a lot of muscle. You'll never match the strength or weight of a prize ox. The greater load, moreover, on the body is crushing to the spirit, and renders it less active. So keep the body within bounds as much as you can, and make room for the spirit. Devotees of physical culture have to put up with a lot of nuisances. There are the exercises in the first place, the toil involved in which drains the vitality and renders it unfit for concentration, or the more demanding sort of studies. Next there is the heavy feeding, which dulls mental acuteness. Then there is the taking on as coaches of the worst brand of slave, persons who divide their time between putting on lotion and putting down liquor, whose idea of a well-spent day consists of getting up a good sweat and then replacing the fluid lost with plenty of drink. All the better to be absorbed on a dry stomach. Drinking and perspiring, it's the life of a dyspeptic. There are short and simple exercises which will tire the body without undue delay, and save what needs especially close accounting for, time. There is running, swinging weights about, and jumping, either high jumping or long jumping, or the kind indulged in by the priests of Mars, if one may so describe it, or, to be rather more disrespectful, by the laundress. Pick out any of these for ease and straightforwardness, but whatever you do, return from body to mind very soon. Exercise it, day and night. Only a moderate amount of work is needed for it to thrive and develop. It is a form of exercise to which cold and heat, and even old age, are no obstacle. Cultivate an asset which the passing of time itself improves. I'm not telling you to be always bent over a book or writing tablets. The mind has to be given some time off, but in such a way that it may be refreshed, not relaxed till it goes to pieces. Travelling in one's carriage shakes the body up and doesn't interfere with intellectual pursuits. You can read, dictate, speak, or listen. Nor does walking, for that matter, preclude any of these activities. Nor need you look down on voice training, though I will not have you practising any of this ascending and then descending again by degrees through set scales. If you start that, you'll be going on to take lessons in walking. Once let into your house the sort of person that hunger teaches unheard-of occupations, and you'll have someone regulating the way you walk and watching the way you use your jaws as you eat, and in fact going just as far as your patience and credulity lead his audacity on. Are you to conclude from what I've just said that your voice should start its exercises with immediate shouting at full force? Well, the natural thing is to lead up to it through easy stages. So natural, in fact, that even persons involved in a quarrel begin in conversational tones. Only later do they go on to rend the air. No one makes an impassioned appeal for the help and support of all true men of Rome at the very outset. Our purpose in all this is not to give the voice exercise, but to make it give us exercise. I have relieved you, then, of no little bother. To these favours there shall be added the following small contribution, a striking maxim that comes from Greece. Here it is. The life of folly is empty of gratitude, full of anxiety. It is focused wholly on the future. Who said that, you ask? The same man as before. And what sort of life do you think is meant by the life of folly? Barbars and Isios? No, he means our own life, precipitated by blind desire into activities that are likely to bring us harm, and will certainly never bring us satisfaction. If they could ever satisfy us, they would have done so by now, never thinking how pleasant it is to ask for nothing, how splendid it is to be complete and be independent of fortune. So continually remind yourself, Lucilius, of the many things you have achieved. When you look at all the people out in front of you, think of all the ones behind you. If you want to feel appreciative where the gods in your life are concerned, just think how many people you've outdone. Why be concerned about others, come to that, when you've outdone your own self? Set yourself a limit, which you couldn't even exceed if you wanted to, and say goodbye at last to those deceptive prizes more precious to those who hope for them than those who have won them. If there were anything substantial in them, they would sooner or later bring a sense of fullness. As it is, they simply aggravate the thirst of those who swallow them. Away with pomp and show. As for the uncertain lot that the future has in store for me, why should I demand from fortune that she should give me this and that, rather than demand from myself that I should not ask for them? Why should I ask for them, after all? Am I to pile them up in total forgetfulness of the frailty of human existence? What is the purpose of my labours going to be? See, this day is my last. Or maybe it isn't. But it's not so far away from it. Letter number 16. It is clear to you, I know, Lucilius, that no one can lead a happy life, or even one that is bearable, without the pursuit of wisdom, and that the perfection of wisdom is what makes the happy life, although even the beginnings of wisdom make life bearable. Yet this conviction, clear as it is, needs to be strengthened and given deeper roots through daily reflection. Making noble resolutions is not as important as keeping the resolutions you have made already. You have to persevere and fortify your pertinacity until the will to good becomes a disposition to good. So you needn't go in for all this long-winded protestation or say any more on the subject. I'm well aware that you've made a great deal of progress. I realise the feelings that prompt you to put these things in your letter, and there is no pretence or speciousness about them, but to give you my honest opinion, at this stage, although I have great hopes of you, I do not yet feel quite confident about you. And I should like you to adopt the same attitude. You've no grounds for forming a ready, hasty belief in yourself. Carry out a searching analysis and close scrutiny of yourself in all sorts of different lights. Consider, above all else, whether you've advanced in philosophy or just in actual years. Philosophy is not an occupation of a popular nature, nor is it pursued for the sake of self-advertisement. Its concern is not with words, but with facts. It is not carried on with the object of passing the day in an entertaining sort of way and taking the boredom out of leisure. It moulds and builds the personality, orders one's life, regulates one's conduct, shows one what one should do and what one should leave undone, sits at the helm, and keeps one on the correct course, as one is tossed about in perilous seas. Without it, no one can lead a life free of fear or worry. Every hour of the day, countless situations arise that call for advice, and for that advice we have to look to philosophy. Someone may say, what help can philosophy be to me if there is such a thing as fate? What help can philosophy be if there is a deity controlling all? What help can it be if all is governed by chance? For it is impossible either to change what is already determined or to make preparations to meet what is undetermined. Either in the first case my planning is forestalled by a god who decrees how I am to act, or in the second case it is fortune that allows me no freedom to plan. Whichever of these alternatives, Lucilius, is true, even if all of them are true, we still need to practice philosophy. Whether we are caught in the grasp of an inexorable law of fate, whether it is God who, as Lord of the universe, has ordered all things, or whether the affairs of mankind are tossed and buffeted haphazardly by chance, it is philosophy that has the duty of protecting us. She will encourage us to submit to God with cheerfulness, and to fortune with defiance. She will show you how to follow God, and bear what chance may send you. But I mustn't pass on here to a discussion of the problem, what is within our control, if there is a governing providence, whether we are carried along enmeshed in a train of fated happenings, or whether we are at the mercy of the sudden and the unforeseeable. For the present, I go back to the point where I was before, to advise and urge you not to allow your spiritual enthusiasm to cool off or fall away. Keep a hold on it, and put it on a firm footing, so that what is at present an enthusiasm may become a settled spiritual disposition. If I know you, you'll have been looking around from the very start of this letter to see what it's going to bring you by way of a little present. Search the letter, and you'll find it. You needn't think my kindness all that remarkable. I'm only being generous still with someone else's property. Why, though, do I call it someone else's? Whatever is well said by anyone belongs to me. Here is another saying of Epicurus. If you shape your life according to nature, you will never be poor. If according to people's opinions, you will never be rich. Nature's wants are small, while those of opinion are limitless. Imagine that you've piled up all that a veritable host of rich men ever possessed, that fortune has carried you far beyond the bounds of wealth, so far as any private individual is concerned, building you a roof of gold, and clothing you in royal purple, conducting you to such a height of opulence and luxury that you hide the earth with marble floors, putting you in a position not merely to own, but to walk all over treasures. Throw in sculptures, paintings, all that has been produced at tremendous pains by all the arts to satisfy extravagance. All these things will only induce in you a craving for even bigger things. Natural desires are limited. Those which spring from false opinions have nowhere to stop, for falsity has no point of termination. When a person is following a track, there is an eventual end to it somewhere, but with wandering at large there is no limit. So give up pointless empty journeys, and whenever you want to know whether desire aroused in you by something you are pursuing is natural or quite unseeing, ask yourself whether it is capable of coming to rest at any point. If after going a long way there is always something remaining farther away, be sure it is not something natural. Letter number 18. It is the month of December, and yet the whole city is in a sweat. Festivity at state expense is given unrestricted license. Everywhere there echoes the noise of preparations on a massive scale. It all suggests that the Saturnalia holidays are different from the ordinary working day, when the difference is really non-existent. So much so, in fact, that the man who said that December used to be a month, but is now a year, was, in my opinion, not far wide of the mark. If I had you with me, I should enjoy consulting you and finding out what course you think we should follow. Should we make no alteration in our daily habits, or should we take off our togas? Time was when a change of formal wear would come about only during periods of grave political upheaval, whereas with us it happens for holidays and pleasure's sake, and have dinner parties with a note of gaiety about them to avoid giving the impression that we disagree with the ways of those around us. If I know you as well as I think I do, and you had to give a decision in the matter, you would say that we should be neither altogether like nor altogether unlike the festive-hatted crowd. But perhaps this is the very season when we should be keeping the soul under strict control, making it unique in abstaining from pleasure, just when the crowd are all on pleasure bent. If the soul succeeds in avoiding either heading, or being carried away in the direction of the temptations that lead people into extravagant living, no surer proof of its strength of purpose can be vouchsafed it. Remaining dry and sober takes a good deal more strength of will when everyone about one is puking drunk. It takes a more developed sense of fitness, on the other hand, not to make oneself a person apart, to be neither indistinguishable from those about one, nor conspicuous by one's difference, to do the same things but not in quite the same manner. For a holiday can be celebrated without extravagant festivity. Still, my determination to put your moral strength of purpose to the test is such that I propose to give even you the following direction found in great men's teaching. Set aside, now and then, a number of days during which you will be content with the plainest of food, and very little of it, and with rough, coarse clothing, and will ask yourself, is this what one used to dread? It is in times of security that the spirit should be preparing itself to deal with difficult times. While fortune is bestowing favours on it, then is the time for it to be strengthened against her rebuffs. In the midst of peace, the soldier carries out manoeuvres, throws up earthworks against a non-existent enemy, and tires himself out with unnecessary toil in order to be equal to it when it is necessary. If you want a man to keep his head when the crisis comes, you must give him some training before it comes. This was the aim of the men who once every month pretended they were poor, bringing themselves face to face with want to prevent their ever being terrified by a situation which they had frequently rehearsed. You must not at this point imagine that I mean meals like Timon's,